This episode is brought to you by Klaviyo. Did you know that top brands drive 50% of their e-commerce revenue with Klaviyo? Consolidate your channels, including email, SMS, mobile push, and reviews, and centralize and use data from across your tech stack to grow your business and revenue faster and more efficiently than ever. Power smarter digital relationships with the platform built for e-commerce. To learn more, head to klaviyo.com/glossy. That's klaviyo.com/glossy. Hello, and welcome back to the Glossy Week in Review podcast. I'm your host, senior fashion reporter Danny Parisi, and I'm here with our international reporter, Zofia Zviglinska. Hello, Zofia.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for being here. You're back in London after being out and about around Europe, which is what we're going to talk about this week, right? You were in Paris first and then Brussels. Did you go anywhere else?
Yeah, just Paris and Brussels.
Paris and Brussels. So you were at Paris Fashion Week. One of the things we're going to talk about on today's episode is what you saw at Paris Fashion Week, what I saw from afar, but mostly your experience since you were there. We'll also talk a little bit about some potential legislation in France and also another one in the US that I added last minute, both kind of aimed at targeting the ultra fast fashion brands. And then finally, we'll take a quick look at Foot Locker's earnings from this week. But let's start with Paris. So how long were you there, Zofia? Were you there for the whole week?
No, just a couple of days here and there, getting a few of the shows, but mostly also focusing on digital fashion, kind of the events that were going on in that space, and like a lot of technology things too. There's been quite a lot of shows as it usually is with Paris, so it always feels like the week kind of drags on quite a bit. So only a couple of days.
All right, so why don't you tell us a little bit about what you observed. I saw a couple things from afar, but I want to focus on your experience because you saw it firsthand. Tell me about some of the interesting stuff you saw, and then I've got some questions for you too.
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, in terms of the Fashion Week itself, I think that there's a big focus on like scale this season. Like a lot of the shows that I saw, whether it was from afar or kind of in person, it was always very focused on making a statement. And, you know, we've been talking about viral moments and kind of where they really land in fashion, especially as, you know, a lot of brands are kind of very focused on social media. But at the same time, you know, some brands just really don't want to get involved because of the whole luxury connotation. So it's interesting to see what's happened this year at the catwalks, which is, you know, like Balenciaga did like this massive screen set where like the whole like ceiling walls were all covered in screens that were projecting stuff as the models walked, and the displays changed like over time. Some of it was like social media related, some of it was like Paris, some of it was like nature backgrounds. And then, you know, Vetements did their typical kind of red background and mass scale, lots of very big silhouettes. I think some of the other shows as well, even like Loewe had a very kind of scaled up presentation. So I think there was a lot of that. Maybe not as much focus on the clothes, but still quite a lot of good collections.
Yeah, I feel like the spectacle of Fashion Week is something that we talk about a lot on this podcast. Jill and I have lamented that New York Fashion Week has lost some of that to me. And I feel like Paris is often the week where I see some of the coolest, most daring, kind of bold show ideas, you know, in terms of just this, like you said, the scale and the spectacle. Also, on the topic of social media, I think it's interesting because I believe it was The Row at Paris Fashion Week where they had no social media policy. They didn't want anybody taking pictures or posting about it at all, which I think is definitely like very luxurious. I think one of the things about being a really ultra luxury brand is that you can get away with not doing stuff that every other brand has to do, like Chanel not doing e-commerce, which is so crazy. But yeah, so it feels like even as the scale is both good for social media and that it encourages, you know, awe and snapping pictures and sharing them and stuff, and then combining that at the same time with a little bit of anti-social media policy, I think makes for an interesting week where it's more about just look at these crazy spectacles and like actually experience it instead of just thinking about how you're going to post it on your story or something.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of it kind of focused on in-person things. I think there was actually a couple of shows where they had like cordoned off sections of the runway just for VIP guests. So there were sections that people generally couldn't get into, even if they were guests. And then, yeah, the Roe thing was a big thing. Slightly anticlimactic in the end, because they ended up just putting out an analog photo lookbook. But, you know, the no phones rule was definitely effective and a nice touch to bring in. Like, they had little notepads on all of the seats instead so people could write down their thoughts.
That is cool. And if you're listening to this and that sounds interesting to you, we are planning a little series on Glossy soon about the different ways brands are kind of like rejecting social media or rejecting other kind of technological things like that. What else did you see at Paris Fashion Week? I'm curious, any other cool stuff stand out to you?
Yeah, I think that especially with the big brands, there's a lot of kind of focus on craftsmanship and kind of the detail and the level of work that needs to go into a luxury collection. I think, you know, nowadays when so many brands are trying to separate themselves away from what's happening with fast fashion, to be honest, you could say that the Rose no photos thing could also kind of play into that because of the fact that, you know, a lot of these collections end up getting imitated straight off the runway through the photos. But, you know, designers and brands like Loewe have, you know, really dug their heels in on the kind of craft and art links to fashion. I think they had a coat with a collar made out of wood. They had like one which was like super, super embroidered with like an old, I think it was a Dutch master or something, but there's a lot of kind of references to art and I guess the avant-garde in their collections. I think it ends up coming through to other designers as well. So for example, like, you know, the new collection from McQueen under their new designer. And to be honest, even with collections like Chloe, you know, the amount of like ruffles that was present on the collection, I think it's very emblematic of the kind of crafting that goes into those kind of runway shows.
That's a good point. And I always like when I can see some non-fashion influence, like visual art or other things, working its way into a fashion collection. That's always very satisfying. One thing I observed from afar, and I wrote about it on Glossy, was, you know, primarily the Saint Laurent show had a lot of sheer, a lot of see-through clothing, a lot of just nudity in general, not just on the runway. There was also that brand Avivav, which you tipped me off to, that had a lot of sheer. That's the one where they had the audience like throw trash at the models, which made me feel really bad for the models. But also in terms of the attendees, there were a lot of celebrities wearing sheer and see-through, which I feel like is kind of a, I don't know, that's like a little bit of a luxurious high fashion kind of thing too. So it's interesting to see that making a comeback. I talked to a couple of people about different reasons why that trend might be here. I don't know, did you see anything more like that other than Saint Laurent? I feel like that was the main one in terms of bringing in that trend.
Yeah, that was definitely the main one. I think there was a lot of like draping and like sheer chiffon, but I think it came up on other runways too. So like Valentino, I think there was a couple of pieces from McQueen that were like that. Victoria Beckham, who always does the kind of satin versus chiffon versus wool thing. And I think even in other collections, like Issey Miyake, who uses that very like thin, I guess, fabric in that classic pleat, which had a bit more translucency to it this season.
I want to move on to our next topic, but before we do, any other interesting things you saw? Anything else that comes to mind, Zofia? It feels like it was a very fun week, so I'm glad you got to be there.
Yeah, it definitely was. And, you know, I think the other thing is, and this is, you know, kind of on a little bit of a sad note, and it doesn't seem like body diversity was a big subject this season. And, you know, this seems like a trend that's kind of come and gone and now is not at the forefront of, you know, the casting or designers' minds. And that is definitely a bit of a shame just because of the amount of work that was going into that. It seemed like there had been real kind of turning point a couple of years ago to move towards a more inclusive casting. But on most of the shows this season, there was no kind of body diversity, age diversity, definitely, you know, racial diversity, definitely. But with body types, it's still a challenge and it should be something that, you know, is more prioritized in the weeks to come.
Yeah, it does feel a little bit sometimes like fashion brands will have a really diverse runway. And then the next season they're like, oh, well, that was last season. We moved on. It's, you know, rather than it being a long-term kind of commitment. So Let's move on to our next topic, though, which is I wanted to talk about this bill that's proposed in French Parliament right now, which targets ultra-fast fashion brands, particularly Shein. And the bill would make those brands liable to pay up to 50% of their selling price in penalties. The idea is to like discourage them from putting out just thousands of new garments every single day, which they do. I think Shein puts out over 7,000 new styles a day, which is so every time I hear that stat, it like is crazy. I think they have nearly 500,000 different styles available in total, which is so crazy to me. There's a couple other proposals floating around in France around banning advertising by those brands and taxing them more heavily, giving cuts to more sustainable fashion. It feels like there is a growing legislative push in France to kind of just cut back on Shein or Temu or any sort of like super ultra fast fashion that costs $1 and, you know, goes in the trash after 2 days. So I don't know. You write a lot about sustainability. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think that it's very much in those lines. You know, when you're talking about European fashion, I think a lot of the times you're talking about pride. And some of the people that I talked to this week in Brussels basically said the same. You know, Pascal, who's the head of the French Fashion Haute Couture Federation, he was saying that it's important to kind of preserve the craft and the origin of fashion and, like, you know, specifically obviously French designers and French fashion houses. But I think it kind of extends, and it felt like, you know, the event that I was at for the European Fashion Alliance, where they were presenting their new report, I think that is a lot of the conversation was kind of focused on that and kind of how to boost European creatives. And, you know, it was with no surprise that fast fashion brands also came up as a direct kind of relationship to how, like, people think about fashion nowadays and, you know, why some people might view it really negatively or see the, you know, the mass quantities of fashion affecting that. I'm not sure if, you know, neither of the French federations nor of the other fashion federations are really able to say that they are completely removed from those systems. You know, a lot of luxury brands have moved their production to China for various goods. So I think it's not quite as removed as they think, but it is interesting that there's almost this more of an approach to, you know, European fashion as like a point of pride that, you know, this is the place where craftsmanship is made. It's not just a made in Italy label. It's also just, you know, who else is kind of producing stuff of a high quality in Europe and how can that be put away? So I'm not surprised that this bill is coming up. And I do think that, you know, Europe in general tends to have a slightly harder push legislative way on fashion. I think some of the US fashion acts and other laws are being stalled or maybe not being put through as quickly. I'm not surprised, and I highly expect that France is going to do something like this because I don't think they get that much from these mass fast fashion brands. And I think they're very much against that kind of lobbying.
Yeah, you had actually told me this thought yesterday when we were talking about this, the idea that fast fashion is not only bad for the environment, but that it's un-European. It's like a point of national or maybe continental pride to not make clothes that way. And it is like, I think global high fashion is kind of, you know, owes a lot to Europe, particularly France and Italy. And I can see how particularly France would have, you know, not just a environmental objection to having thousands of different garments available from one brand every single day, but also it kind of like goes against that tradition in a lot of different ways. Something interesting in the bill was they talk a little bit about not just those effects, but like not just the effects from the brands like Shein, but also the effect that it has on the customer to have that kind of availability around. You know, they talked about how it kind of creates this, when you've got a brand putting out hundreds of new styles every day, and there's thousands of styles every day, it creates this incentive to want something new all the time because there's so much out there and it's so easily available. So it's not just the effect it's having on the environment and the industry, it's also like on the psychology of the consumer, which then strengthens those business models. Because if you're training people to constantly want newness and to buy, you know, giant hauls of, you know, 100 different garments, and it was $50 in total, that doesn't create a good like mindset around fashion, you know, and instead of having the little bit of friction that makes you think more carefully about what you're going to buy and what you're going to wear, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that, you know, it's no, I guess no surprise that Temu's tagline is shop like a billionaire. Like, I think that that's the kind of approach that they're putting out, that you're essentially shopping with no real limits, no kind of
regard. With no limits, yeah.
Yeah. And I think that that's kind of the same thing that, you know, you're seeing the opposite of happening in Europe right now. You know, there's multiple younger brands now which are shifting to like a made to order model or like custom or tailored. Like, those kind of things are becoming more important because they're basically changing their business model to be kind of more sustainable and moving away from the kind of necessity for everything to be on demand and right now. So in a sense, I think you have like the fashion designers on one side trying to shift, you know, consumer psychology, and then the fast fashion brands on the other. You know, depending on, I guess, how much thought you're willing to put into fashion, you'll see kind of which group wins out. But I'm hoping that, you know, Shein and the other Temu and everything else does end up getting stopped in some way, or at least halted through this legislation. And I'm really hoping as well that, you know, Shein has put in a bid for an IPO in the UK now, because the US has basically halted it, I think. So I'm hoping that that doesn't go through either. I'm wondering if the British Fashion Council is going to start, you know, lobbying and asking for them not to be included, which would be a very good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I often think that anytime something is too easy or too cheap, there's usually a reason for that. That's not great. You know, the reason those clothes are so, so cheap is because they're made out of like the worst possible materials and in the worst conditions. Just like the reason you can get anything you want delivered to you in 5 seconds in New York City is because they've got a bunch of people paid very little to to do that. So it's like, it's almost anything like that is too good to be true. Like, if it's good clothes are expensive to make, and they're more expensive to buy, at least more so than like literally under $1 some things are on Shein. So yeah, I often think like if something's too cheap, too easy, then there's a reason for that, and it's probably not good. One final thing I wanted to say, there's also, I just saw it this morning right before we recorded, but there's a similar bill proposed in the US right now called the America's Trade and Investment Act, which would give billions of dollars to companies invested in resale and circularity, and also encourage them to move production from China to places closer to the US, like Latin America. I think this, as of, you know, we're recording this Thursday, I think this was just announced pretty recently, so I haven't had a chance to dig into it too much or talk to any people in the resale space, but I'm definitely going to and get their take on it. But it feels like it's not just in Europe and not just in France. Even in the US, there's, you know, some awareness of trying to curtail ultra fast fashion and move towards something more sustainable. So yeah, that was a last minute thing and I didn't tell you about it. So, but I don't know if you have any thoughts on that bill, Sophia.
No, I think, you know, I've spoken to many brands about nearshoring, and I think that this is almost just an extension of that. You know, for so many years, manufacturing has been basically outsourced to countries in the global south or to China. I think that that's been something that has, you know, been good cost-wise, I guess, for brands, but maybe long-term, it wasn't really the right idea. And, you know, with France, at least, like they're seeing it as, you know, manufacturing clothing in France and in Italy could potentially die down because the craftsmen, the you know, the artisans are not there to work on those projects anymore. And a lot of luxury brands are putting like a lot of money into training and development to make sure that those kind of things stay around because their business model is dependent on it. And I think it extends also to other manufacturing styles too. Like, you know, if you can move things closer, then you're also able to have more control over it. You know, there's been so many kind of geopolitical issues and things that have affected fashion supply chains over the last couple of years. I think for many brands, it just doesn't make as much sense anymore if, you know, the costs everywhere are going up for them to be shipping product or even part of their product, you know, if it's unmade or if it's just the material from places that are really far away. And obviously there's the patriotic boost as well, that something could be manufactured in your country and you could market that.
Yeah, for sure. Cool. Okay, let's move on to our last topic, which is Foot Locker. They had announced their earnings earlier this week. Things are not looking so good for them. They delayed their profitability goal by 2 extra years. They also posted a loss of $389 million during the holidays last year, which is usually when a retailer will see a boost in sales rather than a loss. And all of that led to a 30% drop in their shares after they reported earlier this week. Feels like it's a really tough time for them. Their CEO, Mary Dillon, who was formerly of Ulta, blamed it mostly on inventory levels being really high and then having to have basically constant markdowns to get rid of it all. It feels like inventory is a really big problem for a lot of retailers right now who are just constantly, I don't know what it is, because it seems like the brands that they carry, like Nike and On Running, are both doing super well, and then Foot Locker isn't. So it's just a little bit strange to me. I have some more thoughts, but I'll pause there. Zofia, what's your take on what Foot Locker reported?
Yeah, I mean, I think that maybe it's, again, of being a little bit behind the times, or else like customers are finding better prices elsewhere. But I'm wondering like what the future is, I guess, of these like multi-brand, like sneaker or shoe focused like retailers like Foot Locker are. Like, I don't really know what the appeal is anymore when you can go to a brand direct and, you know, they're fighting really hard to make sure their D2C experience is like the best and like people go to them directly, especially, you know, with all the kind of data things that they can get through their own app or like their own website. Like, it makes sense for them to kind of focus on that, you know, for future customer insights than it would be to, you know, focus on Foot Locker instead. And there might be like better ways of using, I guess, wholesale or like other factors that would make it so that the sneaker kind of part of it would, or the sneaker sale part of it would go up. But I don't know if it's really like a long-term plan or a long-term like possibility for this to have continued growth like it used to over the last 10 years, especially with like the sneaker boom.
Yeah, I mean, I think footwear, sneakers in particular, but footwear in general, is just like a less diverse or like there's just fewer brands, as opposed to like if you're buying a jacket, there's hundreds of different options. But in shoes, I mean, the amount that it's concentrated around a smaller number of brands like Nike and Adidas, and that just have a much bigger market share. And I think I'm making this up on the fly, but I think that means that those brands then get really big. Like, Nike is gigantic, and then because of that, they have more sway and more weight to throw around when they're working with retailers, so they can get better terms. They also can make their own direct channels that are better, or, you know, better suited for people who are just looking for that one particular brand. And all of that means that if you're looking for Nike, you're probably going to have a better experience just buying from Nike than buying from Foot Locker, you know? I also think it's always interesting to see Nike report their earnings and then their strategy, and then Foot Locker report their earnings after, because they always are, there's always like a ripple effect. Nike is and has been the biggest selling brand at Foot Locker for many years. And so when Nike pulls back from wholesale and says like, we're going to focus more on direct, you immediately see the effect on Foot Locker's earnings. And in Foot Locker's last earnings, they talked about how they're deepening their relationship with Nike. They announced this thing called The Clinic, which is going to be this series of joint like social media campaigns and in-person stuff that they're doing with Nike. But at the same time, the amount of Nikes sold at Foot Locker, it was like 60% of all their sales were Nike this quarter, but that's down from 63% the quarter before. So even as they're saying, like, we're deepening our relationship, we're doing more stuff with them, they're selling fewer Nikes. And they're making up for it. Like, On Running has been huge, and Foot Locker sells a lot of On sneakers as well. But I know the loss of the reduction in sales of Nikes at Foot Locker is a big blow for them, because they just rely on that brand so much.
Yeah, definitely. I'm generally very interested in kind of the future of the sneaker and the footwear space. You know, Nike has had layoffs. I believe Adidas has had some layoffs in manufacturing. Like, it's not maybe as big a market as it used to be. And, you know, there's been talks that, especially in resale, that it's quite saturated, and it might just be kind of falling off the cliff a little bit. I'm wondering how that's going to translate to the main market and especially to like new models that they're coming out with, because those are usually like big sales drivers, you know, but maybe if there's not enough of a differentiation from what's already out there, it might just end up being more of the same.
Yeah, I'm on the same page as you. I'm also curious to see how the sneaker market kind of evolves, because again, it seems like the brands are doing okay, although I feel like the sneaker mania of a couple of years ago has maybe died down a little bit. But it's definitely the multi-brand retailers that I'm concerned about going forward. But also, I just feel like there's general, not even just in footwear or sneakers, I feel like a lot of retail, like fashion retailers are struggling at the same time as the brands are doing pretty well. Saks and Nordstrom and all those places just seem to be having a little bit of a tougher time than the brands that they carry. So I guess direct to consumer is still a pretty powerful force. And yeah, I don't know how the retailers are going to handle that. I think that's all the time we have this week, though. But Zofia, thank you so much for joining. And thank you for giving us your report from Paris. It sounds like it was a fun time.
Thank you. Yeah, it was really fun. Looking forward to the next one.
For those of you listening, don't forget to give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you listen to this. That helps us out so much. And also don't forget to subscribe to the Glossy Podcast, because you'll hear interviews with industry insiders every Wednesday and Week in Review episodes every Friday. So until the next time, thanks for listening.